Convened a meeting in Los Alamos of the scientific panel, himself, Lawrence, Arthur Compton, and Enrico Fermi, to discuss their final recommendations to the interim committee.
The four scientists had a freewheeling discussion about the Frank Report, which Compton summarized for them. Of special interest was its call for a non-lethal but dramatic demonstration of the power of the atomic bomb. Oppenheimer was ambivalent. I set forth my anxieties and the arguments against dropping the bomb, but I did not endorse them, he later reported. On June 16, 1945, Oppenheimer signed a short memorandum summarizing the scientific panel's recommendations on the immediate use of nuclear weapons. Addressed to Secretary Stimson, it was a diffident document. The panel members recommended, first, that prior to the use of the bomb, Washington should inform Britain, Russia, France, and China of the existence of atomic weapons and welcome suggestions as to how we can cooperate in making this development contribute to improved international relations. Secondly, the panel reported that there was no unanimity among their scientific colleagues on the initial use of the weapons. Some of the men who were building them proposed a demonstration of the gadget as an alternative. Those who advocate a purely technical demonstration would wish to outlaw the use of atomic weapons, and have feared that if we use the weapons now, our position in future negotiations will be prejudiced. Although Oppenheimer surely sensed that most of his colleagues at Los Alamos and at Chicago's Met Lab favored such a demonstration, he now weighed in on the side of those who emphasized the opportunity of saving American lives by immediate military use. Why? Oddly enough, his reasoning was essentially as Borean as that of the men who favored a demonstration. He had become convinced that the military use of the bomb in this war might eliminate all wars. Oppenheimer explained that some of his colleagues actually believed that the use of the bomb in this war might improve the international prospects, in that they are more concerned with the prevention of war than with the elimination of this specific weapon. We find ourselves closer to these latter views. We can propose no technical demonstration likely to bring an end to the war. We see no acceptable alternative to direct military use. Having offered such a clear, unambiguous endorsement of military use, the panel could come to no conclusion as to how to define military use. As Compton later informed Groves, there was not sufficient agreement among the members of the panel to unite upon a statement as to how or under what conditions such use was to be made. Oppenheimer ended his memo with a curious disclaimer. It is clear that we, as scientific men, have no proprietary rights, no claim to special competence in solving the political, social, and military problems which are presented by the advent of atomic power. It was an odd conclusion, and one that Oppenheimer would soon abandon. There was much that Oppenheimer did not know. As he later recalled, we didn't know beans about the military situation in Japan. We didn't know whether they could be caused to surrender by other means or whether the invasion was really inevitable. But in the backs of our minds was the notion that the invasion was inevitable because we had been told that. Among other things, he was unaware that military intelligence in Washington had intercepted and decoded messages from Japan indicating that the Japanese government understood the war was lost and was seeking acceptable surrender terms. On May 28, for instance, Assistant Secretary of War John J. McCloy urged Stimson to recommend that the term unconditional surrender be dropped from America's demands on the Japanese. Based on their reading of intercepted Japanese cable traffic, codenamed Magic, McCloy and many other ranking officials could see that key members of the Tokyo government were trying to find a way to terminate the war, largely on Washington's terms. On the same day, Acting Secretary of State Joseph C. Grew had a long meeting with President Truman and told him the very same thing. Whatever their other objectives, Japanese government officials had one immutable condition, as Alan Dulles, then an OSS agent in Switzerland, reported to McCloy. They wanted to keep their emperor and the Constitution, fearing that otherwise a military surrender would only mean the collapse of all order and of all discipline. On June 18th, Truman's chief of staff, Admiral William D. Leahy, wrote in his diary, "It is my opinion at the present time that a surrender of Japan can be arranged with terms that can be accepted by Japan." The same day, McCloy told President Truman that he believed the Japanese military position to be so dire as to raise the question of whether we needed to get Russia in to help us defeat Japan. He went on to tell Truman that before a final decision was taken to invade the Japanese home islands or to use the atomic bomb, political steps should be taken that might well secure a full Japanese surrender. The Japanese, he said, should be told that they would be permitted to retain the emperor and a form of government of their own choosing. In addition, he said, the Japs should be told furthermore that we had another and terrifyingly destructive weapon which we would have to use if they did not surrender. According to McCloy, Truman seemed receptive to these suggestions. American military superiority was such that by July 17th, McCloy was writing in his diary, "The delivery of a warning now would hit them at the moment. It would probably bring what we are after, the successful termination of the war." According to General Dwight D. Eisenhower, when he was informed of the existence of the bomb at the Potsdam Conference in July, he told Stimson he thought an atomic bombing was unnecessary because the Japanese were ready to surrender and it wasn't necessary to hit them with that awful thing. Finally, President Truman himself seemed to think that the Japanese were very close to capitulation. Writing in his private, handwritten diary on July 18, 1945, the president referred to a recently intercepted cable quoting the emperor to the Japanese envoy in Moscow as a telegram from Jap emperor asking for peace. The cable said, "Unconditional surrender is the only obstacle to peace." Truman had extracted a promise from Stalin that the Soviet Union would declare war on Japan by August 15th, an event that he and many of his military planners thought would be decisive. "He'll be in the Jap war on August 15th, Truman wrote in his diary on July 17th. "Finny Japs when that comes about." Truman and the men around him knew that the initial invasion of the Japanese home islands was not scheduled to take place until November 1, 1945, at the earliest. And nearly all the president's advisors believed the war would be over prior to that date. It would surely end with the shock of a Soviet declaration of war, or it might end with the kind of political overture to the Japanese that Grew, McCloy, Leahy, and many others envisioned, a clarification of the terms of surrender to specify that the Japanese could keep their emperor. But Truman and his closest advisor, Secretary of State James F. Burns, had decided that the advent of the atomic bomb gave them yet another option. As Burns later explained, "It was ever present in my mind that it was important that we should have an end to the war before the Russians came in." Short of a clarification of the terms of surrender, a move Burns opposed on domestic political grounds, the war could end prior to August 15th only with the use of the new weapon. Thus, on July 18th, Truman noted in his diary, "Believe Japs will fold up before Russia comes in." Finally, on August 3rd, Walter Brown, a special assistant to Secretary Burns, wrote in his diary, "President, Leahy, JFB, Burns, agreed Japs looking for peace." Leahy had another report from the Pacific. "President afraid they will sue for peace through Russia instead of some country like Sweden." Isolated in Los Alamos, Oppenheimer had no knowledge of the magic intelligence intercepts, no knowledge of the vigorous debate going on among Washington insiders over the surrender terms, and no idea that the president and his secretary of state were hoping that the atomic bomb would allow them to end the war without a clarification of the terms of unconditional surrender and without Soviet intervention. No one can be certain of Oppenheimer's reaction had he learned that on the eve of the Hiroshima bombing, the president knew the Japanese were looking for peace, and that the military use of atomic bombs on cities was an option rather than a necessity for ending the war in August. But we do know that after the war he came to believe that he had been misled, and that this knowledge served as a constant reminder that it was henceforth his obligation to be skeptical of what he was told by government officials.